So when Sesshin begins, the teachers have a meeting and decide on a theme or maybe a koan to explore for the Sesshin. And sometimes we stick to that for the whole Sesshin. In this case, it's 7 days long, so we have 6 opportunities to explore something. And Josh and David and I, last night, were inspired by this particular koan that I'm going to read to you. It's from the Book of Equanimity, or the Book of Serenity, which is one of the texts that has come down to us through the Soto School and that we study in our koan practice. And this case that we're going to explore, at least today and perhaps 5 more times, we'll see, is case number 96. It's called Jufeng's Disagreement. And the introduction by Wan Song, the collector of these texts, goes like this. Yun Ju didn't rely on relics, the jewels of discipline. Ju Feng didn't admire sitting or standing death. Niu To didn't need the birds to bring flowers. Wang Bo didn't envy sailing on a wine cup across a river. But tell me, what is their strong point? And the case. Jufeng worked as an attendant of Shishuang. When Shishuang passed away, the community wanted to invite the first ranked monk in the hall to succeed to the abbacy. Jufeng did not agree. He said, "Wait until I have questioned him. If he understands our late teacher's meaning, I'll serve him like our late teacher." Then he asked the chief monk, "The late teacher said, cease, desist, spend 10,000 years in one thought, be cold ashes, dead trees, be a censer in an ancient shrine, be a strip of pure white silk. Now tell me, what does this illustrate?" And the chief monk said, "It illustrates the matter of absolute oneness." Jufeng said, "Then you still don't understand the late teacher's meaning." The chief monk said, "You don't agree with me? Set up some incense." The chief monk then lit the incense and said, "If I don't understand the late teacher's meaning, then I won't be able to pass away while this incense is still burning." So saying, he sat down and died. Jufeng then caressed his shoulder and said, "As far as dying, seated or standing is concerned, you're not lacking. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it." And Tiantong Hongzhi's verse says, "The school of Shishuang was personally transmitted to Jiufeng. Passing away in incense smoke, the true bloodline cannot go through. The crane nesting on the moon has a 1,000-year dream. The man in the snowy room is deluded by the achievement of oneness. Cutting off the 10 directions still gets a failing mark. Quietly move a step, and behold a flying dragon." So we like this koan for many reasons. It's an interesting story, for one thing, and it actually contains the seeds of a number of interesting stories, which I might get to tell you one or two of today. But the deep point is this chief monk's misunderstanding of the Dharma. And it's easy to understand his misunderstanding, because if we intellectually hear Jiufeng's words quoting his old teacher, Shishuang, it sounds like he is, in fact, pointing to emptiness, to oneness, to shunyata. And this chief monk thinks, and that's an important word here, he thinks he understands this meaning. This is such a pointer for us in our style of practice, which does not favor oneness over diversity. It doesn't favor yang over yin, or emptiness over form. It understands, as one of our ancestors in the Dharma so beautifully puts it, Yamada Kon. He says, the world of oneness is simultaneously the world of common sense. That's an important pointer. Our way in Boundless Way Zen, as we've come to develop it over the years that we've been together, is to awake to the aliveness of each moment. It's one of the reasons why I requested of Steve that we chant, that we recite the text from one of our Korean ancestors, Chinul, Secrets on Cultivating the Mind, where he points again and again to the same teaching. So important. The nature of the mind is unstained. It's originally whole and complete in itself. That sounds like, intellectually, that we should be moving towards oneness. But it's important to know the second thing that Chinul points out, which is when people are deluded, they assume that the four great elements are the body and the false thoughts are the mind. They do not know that their own nature is the true Dharma body. They do not know that their own self-illuminating awareness is the Buddha. And as Josh pointed out in his introductory remarks last night, if we get stuck in thinking that it looks a certain way or feels a certain way, then we miss something that is life-giving. Our appreciating and our non-appreciating are equally the signs of a Buddha, an awakened one. We're already awakened, but we don't know it, and we keep trying to figure it out, sort it out, favor one state over another. But in this great way of ours, it's important to know that every single thing that we do, think, feel, say, is an expression of the wholeness of our awakened nature. We're not trying to get rid of anything. What we are doing is practicing being awake to everything without making good and bad, but recognizing that sometimes bad arises and sometimes good arises, and they're both manifestations of the awakened nature. That's hard to understand intellectually, and it's particularly interesting to me that in this koan, which is about Jiu Feng, who lived in the 10th century, so closer to our own time than some of the Tang Dynasty masters we hear about, he was the attendant, the jisha, to the teacher, which is, you know, a high-ranked position in a way, but the chief monk had a much higher rank. The chief monk had been working with Shi Shuang, who was a very absolutist teacher, very strong teacher. And the chief monk thought that he understood the teacher's meaning, so that he could prove this by showing how present he was in the absolute by dying, which kind of, if you really look at it logically, doesn't make any sense at all, because he was trying to prove that he was the correct successor to Shi Shuang. And, you know, he kind of, that's like, I guess, shooting yourself in the foot, which is an old Zen saying. So the one of the moments in this koan that is very touching to me, and I checked a bunch of translations last night in preparing for the talk, as I love to do, because we don't know Chinese, and we don't know what these people are really saying, and people interpret them over the centuries. So in many of the translations of this, including in some of the books that have been published, Jiu Feng, after the chief monk dies, pats him on the back. But in our lineage, which is derived from the Three Treasures lineage through John Tarrant and Robert Aitken and Yamada and Yasutani, the translation says, Jiu Feng then caressed his shoulder. That seems to me a very different sensibility from patting him on the back. It's a recognition that even though the chief monk tied himself up in knots, I'll use that as a less violent version of what he did, by dying in absolute oneness, he still was a full Buddha, a Buddha in wholeness, completely. And Jiufeng felt an affection for him, a warmth for him. He wasn't just a screw-up that we need to dismiss out of hand. He was another human being, another Buddha, just like us. And that, of course, in that moment, that might be the key demonstration of Jiufeng, of his understanding, which is, again, pointing to Yamada's words about oneness being the other side of common sense. In Wansong's commentary, he talks about the poor chief monk being a board-carrying fellow. I first heard this phrase from one of our senior students, and I didn't know what it meant, and he patiently explained it to me, that when you're carrying a big board on your shoulder, you can only see one side of things. If you're carrying it on your right shoulder and you look to the left, you see the world, but if you look to the right, you just see the board. And this, of course, is the chief monk's problem. And Wansong also says, which I think is another example of the tenderness of our way, of the humanness of our way, that when Jiufeng quotes Shi Shuang, and he seems to be pointing to emptiness, again, intellectually, it feels like he's talking about oneness, cease, desist, spend 10,000 years in one thought, cold ashes, dead trees, a strip of pure white silk. He says that he wishes that the chief monk had just looked at Jiufeng in that moment and said, I don't get it the way you get it. I don't understand the way you understand. And that then Jiufeng couldn't have done anything other than bow to him in gratitude. Because it's the humanness that we're looking for. The humanness of being fully one, if we're a board-carrying fellow, being a really true board-carrying fellow, knowing that we only get one side, and being humble about that. Because, of course, you've heard us say so many times, this practice is ongoing for our whole lives. And again, Chinul, our Korean ancestor, points this out. He talks about sudden awakening and gradual cultivation as being the two wheels of the cart. One without the other is useless. And those of us who've had a sudden awakening know the work we've had to put into integrating that into every moment of our lives. And those of us who have had a life devoted to gradual cultivation know that that in itself, while important, is sweetened, you might say, by maybe little moments of awakening, really seeing a flower, really feeling raindrops on our head, really tasting our food. Big or small doesn't matter, but both of these streams of awakening are alive in all human beings, and they support each other. Both sides eventually just become one vividly lived life. And in the introduction, all these references are to stories of people who could demonstrate oneness, even magical powers, but couldn't see that whole living quality, that ordinary humanness. So Yun Ju met a hermit who was sitting alone and had appeared to transcend all mundane things. And Yun Ju asked him, show me your mother and father before you were born. And he couldn't do it. He worked on it for the rest of his life and then died. And when he was cremated, jewels appeared. And Yun Ju said, well, the jewels are nice. But not being able to answer that question, if only he'd been able to answer that question, then he would have known this life of awakening. And Yu To, apparently, he was a Dharma era, our fourth Chinese ancestor, started his own line, which eventually died out. And he used to sit in stillness, and birds would fly to him and put flowers in his lap and surround him with flowers. And he famously realized that that also wasn't what he was going for. It was all very well to be surrounded by flowers, but he wanted to be a living human being. And Wangbo, who was Lin Ji's teacher, this is, I think, the most famous story. Some of you might be familiar with it. He was standing at the river's edge with another monk, and the monk said to him, "Can you perform miracles?" And Wangbo said, "Yes, I can perform miracles." Hakuin later quoted this, "When I'm hungry, I eat, and when I'm tired, I sleep." And the monk said, "That's nothing," and floated across the water in this case, a wine cup, I guess, across the river, and Wangbo just shook his head. Yeah, so these miracles, dying when the incense is burning, staying stuck in emptiness, this, as Robert Aitken likes to say, butters no parsnips, a famous line from our lineage. We're in the business of buttering parsnips. We're in the business of having our tender human hearts lead us. We're in the business of being fully awakened human beings who are not stuck. And when we're stuck, we're stuck in being human. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable, and we're going to have our Dharma dialogue, which is a time when you can ask questions, you can make comments. It doesn't have to be about the talk or the koan. It can be about anything in practice, but it also could be about the talk or the koan. And you notice that we have the three of the guiding teachers up here, but we also have one of our newly minted Dharma holders, Kate. So she will also be, if she feels moved to do that, answering or responding to your questions and comments. So just raising your hand if you have something. And if I can't see you, someone will see you. Yes, Christine.
Listening to you, I could just feel my heart open in these tears of relief and joy and just softening. It's like, oh, thank God, I was going to say about that. Thank you.
Steve, and then Alan.
So you quoted a line from Chimul about people who are deluded think the four elements are the body and that false thoughts are the mind. And so that line has always bothered me a little bit, this thing about false thoughts. And could you say a little bit about, so people who are deluded think that these false thoughts are the mind. Is there a going beyond delusion and having only right thoughts here?
Not at all. As I look up the reference, somebody else is going to answer your question.
All thoughts are false thoughts. There's not the right kind of thoughts. There's not the right kind of content of consciousness that's it. And you should only have that content of consciousness. Poor people believe, these foolish people believe that some content of consciousness is it.
Right.
That's the false thought. As for not false thoughts, how you doing?
Yeah, and later on, you know, that last part really points to this teaching when he says, the thought that does the cutting is a brigand, a thief. Right, you know, it's not. We're not trying to cut off thoughts. That would be this being stuck in delusion, and that you can. And then he says, if they could see, I love this line. If they could see the thoughts of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, and lying. Wow, we hear that and we go, no way, I'm not going to do that. All arise from the nature of mind, and this is a translation of a word that also means the heart, the nature of the heart mind. Then their arising would be the same as their non-arising. Right? At their source, they're calm. Why must they be cut off? That's real. That it's, and calm is maybe a funny translation, but at their source, they're part of this awakened mind. So there's no need to cut them off, but just, he says, don't be late, don't be tardy in being aware of them. So what we're developing here is the capacity to see thoughts as thoughts in their arising and not favor. Yeah. And the delusion is that some thoughts are good and some thoughts are bad and the bad ones should be cut off.
And in the midst of practicing this teaching from Chenuel, that seeing that even our most horribly distressing, aggressive, angry, grasping thoughts arising are just arisings. Also, please act in accord with the precepts. So that is not a dispensable part of that. And again, that those are also the two wheels. Acting in accord with the precepts, and seeing that even thoughts of killing, lying, stealing, sexual misconduct are just arisings. And all of it is included. And pay attention to our behavior and be acting in the service of all beings.
So that line you just quoted, Melissa, about cutting off thoughts, it's not entirely clear to me what he's saying there about cutting, because he says something like followers of the way are cutting off thought after thought, right? And then they don't realize that, you know, that cutting off the thoughts is a brigand. And so it's not entirely clear to me whether he's saying that you should cut off thoughts or not cut off thoughts.
What's your understanding?
And I think David wants to say something too, but tell us your understanding.
Well, so my understanding is that we aren't actually, you know, cutting off thoughts, right? That thoughts arise, and there's really no way to cut them off. They arise on their own. So I'm just a little, but why he says followers of the way cut off thought after thought, it seems like he's pointing out something that's in error here.
Well, actually, in that text, he's talking about people that sit in a dead stillness. So I think that's all part of him talking about these ways we can practice that take us off the mark. So I agree with your interpretation. This, we are not in the business of cutting off thought after thought, because that's another idea.
And he doesn't say followers of the way. He says hearers of the teaching, in a lowercase kind of way.
Okay.
It's people will hear this, and then they go, yes, okay, I hear you. I am totally going to still my mind, quiet my mind, cut off thoughts.
And it's great, you know, he says they sit rigidly without moving. They're like a rock crushing grass. Like, that's supposed to be a good thing. And, you know, there are some teachings and some forms of Buddhism and even Zen that do emphasize that. Not Chenuel, not our way.
So in a way, we just got to where my question goes. I want to say I love the fact we're going to do that koan all week, because it's so funny. And it's nice to be reminded that Buddhists have a sense of humor. In fact, my first reaction to the guy who says he can die during the incense burning down in the desert is, it's a great trick, but you can only do it once. But, you know, and then that, and the being cremated and having the jewels, it's kind of silly, right? And so I was trying to think, well then, you know, how do I see that in me, since I can't do those things? And I realized that some of the miracles I want to perform are like, I want to sit for 25 minutes and not have a thought, you know, or I want to have one of those Kensho experiences and, you know, hear a cricket chirp and go, I have no body and no mind, and, you know, or I want to be a better person. And so really, I'm just as silly as this guy that wants to die as the incense burns.
Yeah, I think that's so important to put ourselves in the different places. So it's easy to say, well, that's silly. I would never. So to really say, like, this is talking about us. Like, each one of us has some fantasy that we think, if only, you know, I could walk across water, if only I could sit for 20, you know, whatever. So to really, I think so important to to not separate ourselves. You know, this is us, those silly people who think something else is going to happen.
And so, if only is one side, right? If only I could do that, and then there also, you know, is the other side. If I can do that, I can sit for 25 minutes and not have a thought, so I'm all set. And you know, so that is it. And so we can fall into the trap either of succeeding or not succeeding.
I think that's what one son was pointing to in his commentary, you know, when he says, oh, if only he just said, you know, I don't get it, that would have demonstrated his attainment in a way of attaining nothing. but yeah, that you know, this is an interesting point too. I'm thinking maybe, Paul, you should reconsider ordination. You know, just really does put you in a difficult position. There is a tendency, you know, here we are wearing all these fancy robes, and you know, we could get into this thing that Josh was just talking about. Look at me, you know, I have a robe, I'm really cool. And we're here to tell you that they're actually somewhat burdensome, so it doesn't look as good as it. For the inside is not as good as the outside. But just to see that this humanness of trying to create a veneer of something over the ordinary humanness, that gets us in trouble all the time, and we all do it. Everyone I know does it. It's not just priests.
The question that I have about both, you know, the being one with and being separate, and the having an experience, a thought, I'll say. I think of someone and I feel their suffering. Okay. Now, this, at some level, this is a thought, yet it's a feeling, and accompanied by a feeling, and that's felt, you know, fully, and yet it's just a thought and a feeling. It's hard to hold both. At least for me. Does that make sense?
Hold both.
That it's impermanent, that it's passing, that it's only a thought. Right? And yet, fully experienced, it's hard to just see it as just a thought. It's like it becomes what is. And so I experience that. But yet, in the realm of the absolute, it's just a passing phenomenon.
What was it, Isa, who said the world of do is the world of do, and yet. So this quality of what? Is it this or is it that? I feel your mind wanting to hold on to it in some way. And there's this, but in the middle of that, what is it? It's true, it's here, it's alive, it's momentary, it's empty, it's form, it's emptiness. And the mind cannot grasp this.
Right.
So it's not, to say it's one is incorrect, to say it's two is incorrect. To open your mouth is incorrect.
So what's my relationship with it?
Oh. Well, this is one of the things that is so important about the power of Zazen. Because Zazen is not contemplation, it's not figuring things out, it's not trying to get what the difference between form and emptiness is. It's in a way receiving both, and letting that, letting the power of the practice itself reveal this integration. You can't do the integration, but the integration is already here. It's like this whole world is filled with it, and we keep dividing, form and emptiness, this and that. So in Zazen, if you can see your thoughts trying to figure it out, then you see that they're thoughts arising. Period. You don't have to solve this problem. You can't solve this problem. But the problem is already solved. It's already accomplished.
Because there is no problem?
No, it's really, really a problem for Ray. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's problem, and Ray's not the only one. You know who you are. I know who you are. And it's just like the people who go, wait a minute, what? That's a great, fertile ground, that wait a minute, what? You, it's not important to figure this out. It's important to feel how difficult it is to figure it out.
Yeah. For me, there's a little bit of liberation, I guess, around fully feeling whatever that thing is that comes forward without making it an identity, mm-hmm. without giving it solidity, so that you can move on from it then, not always, you know, I'm angry at this person, that's it, that's, you know, that's how I feel about them, and it's determined. But knowing that these things come and go, being able to let go of it, and also relate to that person in another way that isn't angry. Fully feeling the anger or whatever it is that you're thinking of at the time, but recognizing that it's not the whole story.
And it's the nature of mental formations, thoughts and feelings, for those thought and feeling beings to claim to be truth, to claim to be it in its entirety, that comes with these thoughts. They're just saying, I am all that's here! And we can notice, oh, yeah, that is what it feels like, isn't it? And it doesn't feel like anything other than that. That's the way it feels.
Bob?
As I was listening to the koan, just sort of letting it wash over me, I felt like the whole thing was a snapshot of my mind in the space of about a minute. It'll be like, I get it. Oh, wait, no, I don't get it. Oh, yeah, I do. And actually, other people think I get it, too. And then, boy, I did something really cool there. And then, you know, it's like, just the whole thing was like, yeah, that was a mini moment for me, and then it moved on.
Thank you. Yeah, Paul.
So this morning I had a wonderful experience with oatmeal, I feel again this kind of come up and this head monk aspect that's there. I feel like I need to embody the forms. I need to show as far as what the forms are. And yes, and when the oatmeal was coming in, when Mike was preparing to serve us, I tapped Piccolo to bring his hands to Gassho, and I picked up a bowl, and I served, and I picked up my little bowl.
Nice.
And I didn't know it at the time, but just set it there, and I come back, and I look, and there it is. Not the Buddha bowl. And so, plop, put it in the Buddha bowl. I just come back to sit. And so, I still intend to ordain.
Because any of our priests can tell you you're on the right track. You know, this is how all of our forms happen. For many generations now, people will get their oatmeal in their little bowl and then plop it into their Buddha bowl. Why do you do that? Oh, I saw. The head monk did it. I can do it too.
One of the things that struck me is the name of the koan and then the demonstration of that, the disagreement. I was thinking about his courage to disagree with basically the whole town, you know, that
the town was like ready to install the next the head monk, and no questions asked, and surely this is the right guy because of his title, right? You know, he's the one. And here's this one person who says, wait a minute, you know, and just the courage to do that.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Really important point.
Well, I think of times in my life when I've done that, it's really hard to do that. Really hard. You've probably done it too. And I bet there are other people here, and boy, you get a big backlash. But you have to do what's true in your heart, and then be willing to be wrong.
Well, I felt a sensitive identity with that that head monk. During the first sitting period this morning, I found myself feeling a lot of ill will towards a work colleague of mine. I thought, oh, that's interesting. And the feeling was coming from that he'd gotten some unmerited favors, and he had not paid his dues in the same way that I had for this kind of thing. So I can kind of, you know, get into that head monk's head. He's been head monk, he's been studying, he's been the closest person to this. He's just ready to step into this destiny that he's been preparing for all this time. You know, and then this upstart comes up, and it, to me, it makes perfectly sense that he would rather die than not get this thing that he is due after all this work. Yeah. Yeah. We're kind of silly, aren't we?
We are. Yeah. Tragically silly.
But I think until we really see the depth of our attachment to being right or being the one, it's so easy to hear the teaching and say, oh yeah, non-attachment, I'm all for that. but I think here we really begin to see that this is so deep and so that there is some kind of death required. And most, you know, it's like, do you want to be right or do you want to be in relationship? Well, actually, a lot of times I want to be right. and to really admit that rather than saying, no, you know, so to really to identify with the head monk, this is us. Yeah.
Pearson the monk.
I have just been thinking about what was said about cutting off thoughts, and that was very helpful to me because I've always been a little upset by that phrase, partly because it seems like a kind of a violent thing to do, to cut them off. And letting them go, or opening the hand, is a little better. Letting be, which somebody mentioned to me recently, is a little better still. But the idea, which I'm not even sure I can formulate, and maybe I shouldn't, but something that was said about occupying a place between success and non-success is helpful to me to hear at this stage of the retreat. I don't know that it's even necessary for me to formulate it any more explicitly, because if it becomes a concept that is intended to guide me throughout the retreat, then perhaps that will illustrate what I'm always doing. But at any rate, I'm grateful for this comment on cutting off thought. I think actually that appreciating the part that I don't appreciate is also a very helpful phrase. So, thank you for that.
I appreciate the care you took there into not falling into one side or the other. And I want to add that sometimes it arises as success Sometimes it arises as non-success. Sometimes it arises as space between success and non-success. So don't imagine there's some minute single tipping point where you can just totally equanimously surf.
Darn.
and that's an important perspective from the other side as well.
Thank you. That was the concept that I was about to formulate.
Right, and you didn't go there.
You know, in terms of the board carrying fellow, I realized that all of us are board carrying fellows. You know, it goes back to what you were saying, Ray, and we can just keep changing the shoulder we have the board on, right? That's a little bit like what you were pointing to. Or we could put the board down, but then I think Pierce just showed that all three things are happening, and we don't have to be married to any one of them, but stay present to all of these shifts and changes. So maybe, Mike, you had your hand up. And then Maddie.
I guess I had two things. One, I was wondering about the end of the koan. How does it end again? What does... I just couldn't remember, and it seems
the
important.
End of the koan itself?
Yes, yeah.
Oh. Jifeng then caressed his shoulder.
Yeah.
And said, as far as dying, seated or standing is concerned, you're not lacking. Right?
Yeah.
Good work. Right. Yeah. But as for our late teacher's meaning, you still haven't even dreamed of seeing it. And that's a very famous line. Sometimes it's translated as, you haven't seen our true teacher's meaning, even in a dream. Mm. You know, which is a very powerful part of the koan. Mm-hmm. All of it. There's a lot buried in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What strikes you?
So I was just thinking about, you know, our talk about, you know, letting thoughts be, go, whatever. And this relationship with thought about not necessarily fully buying in, and yet on the flip side, you know, being willing to step forth. Here's this character who, in the midst of, maybe he was completely wrong. Maybe this Jisha, you know, actually had his head up his ass, and he stepped forth, you know, maybe we're wrong in how we're interpreting this koan. Maybe that head monk was remarkable. I just look at the whole thing, and I think we're doing this big dance around, like, you know, who knows? I look at the whole story, and I don't know who was right and wrong in the whole thing, but one of them lived.
True. And what's your sense of it in your own heart? Because
yeah.
That's where we're guided into koans.
Yeah.
It goes back to what Laura was saying, by our sense of things.
Well, I get the sense that the Jisha had conviction about this head monk, and I think it is important that he was able to challenge him. So there's something good about following through with that. And at the same time, it seems to end with such certainty. I guess I don't necessarily feel that same sense of certainty about the whole thing. It's a funny thing, because I also, this is a realm in my life that I struggle with. Like, so I have a thought where I feel like this is the right thing. And I have a tendency not to speak from that place. I have a tendency to suppress that. Then on other times when I dare to step forth and do that, I say, I shouldn't have done that.
Oh.
And so here's this, I don't know, it's just, I think it's an interesting dance that we're doing, you know, like between when to indulge a thought and express it, when not to, how right are we when we do.
Well, and if we look at the reading by Chenul, I mean, we tend to be to try not to say ill things about other kinds of Buddhists, even though they're wrong. Chenul didn't feel any compunction. Like in that reading, part of what's inspiring about it, he says, there is a way, and it's not this, and it's not this, here it is. I think we do have to stand for something, and as Melissa said, it has to be the way of our heart, and whether it's right, it's probably not right for everybody, but I think that there is a way that we can put the lid over ourselves, say, well, I will always be nice to everyone, and diminish ourselves. And mm-hmm. I think you're pointing to that. And sometimes when we come forward and say something strongly, the judge comes in, well, who do you think you are? But yet I think to accomplish our way, we have to believe in something that can't be fixed and can't be evaluated in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, so the easy to see the monk as the fall guy here, mm-hmm. But maybe something wonderful. Maybe we all should die every round mm-hmm. before the incense burns down. You know, mm-hmm. die again and again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He didn't mean that literally,
right?
Get sued or something.
Yeah, some wisdom in it too. I guess that's what I'm noticing.
Yeah.
You go first, then I'll go.
Mm-hmm. This koan isn't about right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's not what's happening here. Mm-hmm. That is not in this koan.
And in fact,
you're wrong.
And
it's meeting. Mm-hmm. It's meeting both of those arisings: mm-hmm. the arising mm-hmm. of right and the arising of wrong, spaciously, and flexibly, and not fully getting lost. Yeah.
And remember that Jiefeng caressed his shoulder.
Yeah, right. That's
right. There's a real heart mm-hmm. connection going mm-hmm. on there. That's very important. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, for myself, for many many years, I was. Like a spokesperson for the one Dharma, mm-hmm. right? That and that everybody is right in their own way.
Right.
And that's still probably true, mm-hmm. because there are many manifestations of Dharma in the world that aren't even Buddhist, non-Buddhist forms of Dharma. You know, every spiritual practice has adherents who really love it, mm-hmm. and they're really into it. For me personally, mm-hmm. it makes me sad. Mm-hmm. This koan makes me sad. Mm-hmm. I've known so many people mm-hmm. who have been stuck in oneness and prize that and mm-hmm. do great harm, mm-hmm. and my heart breaks about it. And my heart breaks for this head monk in the same way. Yeah. So that's my entry point.
Right.
And your entry point might be a little different.
Right.
And this is the great thing. Those of you who don't work with koans, and even some of you who do, might not know this, but we really favor your heart connection to the story over some right and wrong thing. And if people come in, you know, some people come in and they say the right thing, but there's nothing in it. It's kind of like they haven't come to it through this process you're engaged in right now, Mike, mm-hmm. of really saying, I don't get it. And that's, again, what Wansong wishes mm-hmm. for the head monk, mm-hmm. that he'd only done that. Then he would have been acknowledged by Jiefeng. So this is the work we're engaged in, really. It's not, you can't pin it down, mm-hmm. and yet, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really, thank you for bringing that in. And Maddie's going to be the last comment, I think, or question.
So koans are very frustrating to me. When I hear them at the beginning of a Dharma talk, the koans and the cases, especially this one, right now, is there's just so much in it, and there are so many images and so many choice points for the people involved, and I find myself not so much noticing what's going on in the content of the koan, but just being placing, and not even identifying with the characters, but sort of trying to place myself outside of it so that I can look at it like it's in a little snow globe or something, and I can like figure it out and judge like which ones, like which things are good in it, which things are bad, which things are metaphors for whatever, and so that's kind of that is what's coming up for me right now, I guess. It's just the how my mind works sometimes, just trying to figure out every single thing about it and actually missing what's going on in the koan itself.
Beautifully put. I think many of our minds work that way. I can't really see you, but I know you're there. And you expressed it, and that in itself is worth everything, to be able to see your mind revealed to you. That's partly what we're doing. And maybe someday you'll dive into that snow globe and live inside it, but if, you know, that'll happen when it happens. For right now, really fully being present to being outside the snow globe, I love that metaphor, and just watching how that feels and whether it happens in other parts of your life and just getting to know it intimately. Again, the practice takes care of itself. When you're ready to go in that snow globe, you'll find yourself inside it and you'll go, oh wow. And then you might make a concept of it and then we start again, right? So this is the work. It's wonderful. The joy, the play of our practice.
And in the snow globe isn't better. Mm-hmm. And noticing outside the snow globe isn't worse. And being outside of the snow globe, you have the opportunity to practice with the thought of, God, inside must be so better. Man, I hate being outside. Or whatever arises for you in the forms of grasping, aversion, and certainty. And part of what all of these practice forms do, the liturgy, but especially koans and also the rest of our forms, is they provoke and they give us the opportunity to, in many contexts, over and over again, meet these subtle ways where aversion and grasping and stories arise. And we don't need to not have aversion, grasping, and stories. We just need to notice, oh, wow, look at that. Grasping at the inside of the snow globe. Wow, certainty that inside has to be better.
So for today, that's the last word of Zen. Thank you.